This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 40 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me is Zachary Frueling. Today, we're going to be talking about essential Trek philosophy in the seventh season of Star Trek, The Next Generation. Hey, Zachary, first of all, do you want to report any long-lost sons, brothers, cousins, sisters, nephews, moms, dads?
Well, everyone does seem to find an extra family member in Season 7 of The Next Generation.
I know, right? Even the computer gets in on the act. That whole episode where the computer actually has a child, it seems to be a overriding theme throughout all of Season 7 of The Next Generation.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that, Mike, because I've always kind of wondered why Season 7 of The Next Generation has such an emphasis on family. I mean, I know that family is becoming a theme of the show. I mean, in the very last episode of Season 7 of The Next Generation, Picard, you know, comes to realize that he has more of a familial relationship with his crew than he had realized in the past 7 years. So family is definitely a theme, but they really laid it on thick, I thought, in Season 7.
Yeah, I agree. And I have to say, Zachary, in keeping with our Essential Trek philosophy series that we've been doing, Season 7 of The Next Generation was a little bit difficult for me because it seemed like I have a lot of favorites, and I know you and I were talking about this in the Turbo Lift. I had a lot of favorites in this season, but not a lot of them were philosophically rich. I actually, going back and looking at our catalog of past Metatrex episodes, we've actually covered a lot of the really good ones from Season 7 in many of our previous episodes of Metatrex. So it's kind of tough. And I have to say that in the end, I just had to go with what I felt were the best, strongest, philosophically rich episodes. And some of them are going to be episodes that we've talked about previously here on Metatrex.
Yeah, likewise. I think you and I are on the same page. I actually really enjoy Season 7 of The Next Generation. Some of my favorite TNG episodes are in this season. But the ones that made my list aren't necessarily my favorite episodes, although there are a couple that I would put on my list of favorite episodes. But generally, my favorite episodes in Season 7 are not the most philosophically rich ones. I know I like them for other reasons. I like the family element, or I like the humor, or I like the concept. But in terms of the philosophy, I'm actually kind of surprised I found as much as I did. Season 7, like Season 7 of most of the other shows, Season 7 is not of TNG is not my favorite season of TNG. Same thing with Voyager. Season 7 of Voyager is not my favorite season of Voyager. I was surprised both that I found a fairly large number of episodes that I remembered I really do like, and I was surprised that I found it as easy to put together a list of philosophically rich episodes as I did.
To remind our listeners about our Essential Trek philosophy series, you and I hatched this idea. You know, some of the other shows on the network have essentials, and they go season by season in order, and they talk about some of the essential episodes based on whatever criteria that they deem necessary. But for Metatrex, as our listeners know, we talk about Star Trek and philosophy, or rather, oftentimes, philosophy through the lens of Star Trek. So we wanted to actually do something unique, and that is to identify within the Star Trek franchise the episodes of Star Trek that were essential philosophy episodes. And rather than going in a particular order, we decided to go in reverse order rather than forward. So we started, obviously, with the most current iteration of Star Trek, which is Enterprise Season 4, and we've done Voyager and Deep Space Nine Season 7s, and we've also got plans going forward for the final season of Star Trek, the original series, as well as our next edition will be the animated series, and we're just going to cover that all in one show. So I think this has been interesting to do it this way, but honestly, I think it was smart in that, Zachary, we've been able to kind of knock out the tough ones first, because you're right. These final seasons, season sevens for, you know, three of these franchises. And then, you know, for Enterprise, it was season four. And, you know, for the original series, it's season three. It just seems like there's a lot of loose ends to be tied up. We've kind of talked about this before, tying up those loose ends and getting the storylines wrapped up. And they're just not always really rich in their philosophical content. So I think we've kind of knocked the hard ones out first. And I think that's certainly the case here for Next Gen as well.
I should say also, Mike, that I don't think of our take on any particular season of Star Trek as the definitive word on this. You know, each time we do one of these Essential Trek episodes, you know, I pick my top five, you pick your top five. It's not that the other episodes in those seasons aren't philosophically rich. It's just that we're trying to pick the best of the best of the best for the Essential Trek philosophy episodes. I think it's a testament to the richness of Star Trek in general that I could literally go episode by episode by episode and find something philosophically relevant to talk about in almost every single episode of Star Trek. So this isn't to say that, you know, episodes we don't cover aren't philosophically rich, or that, you know, these are qualitatively better episodes than the others in any way. Some of my favorite episodes don't make the cut for Essential Trek philosophy. Some of the ones that do make the cut are subject to whatever I'm finding interesting that particular week. And, you know, like I said, every episode of Star Trek has something that it says philosophically. And it would be interesting to do a different version of this Essential Trek philosophy series where we don't restrict ourselves to our top five. And we literally just go bam, 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 bam through every single episode and mention what the philosophical themes would be. I feel like I'm leaving out as much as I'm putting in these episodes.
Well, maybe that's something for us to consider doing in the future. We could, you know, we could do a 2-minute... philosophical nugget in each episode of each season. That might be fascinating. You mentioned that we each have about five episodes, and that's the case. Zachary, you and I have both selected five episodes that we feel are particularly rich in philosophical content. I also have a couple of honorable mentions. And like you, that this isn't definitive in any way. This is just, you know, five episodes that I found to be intriguing and rich in philosophical content. Again, there are other episodes that I feel have good philosophical content, and they just didn't make my list. There were probably about four or five other episodes that I could have easily put on my list. Now, you and I haven't compared our lists. I want to remind our listeners that we didn't compare lists, so I'm excited to hear what made your list. And sometimes we agree on episodes and sometimes we don't, but as always, we hope that our listeners will jump in the conversation under our show thread in the Babel Conference and share with us what were some favorites of yours based on the philosophical content of them.
Yeah, I think not sharing our list is really part of the fun in doing these Essential Trek philosophy shows. In some cases, our intuitions have matched up and we've had a lot of overlap. In some cases, we've made very different choices. So I'm curious to see what will happen with season 7 of TNG, not having seen your list.
Indeed. Well, let's dive right in, Zachary. And since I'm hosting this particular episode, how about you go first?
Passing the buck, huh?
I'm just trying to be a good host.
Well, Mike, the first episode that made my list of top five Essential Trek philosophy episodes from season 7 of TNG is Force of Nature. And if you remember, Force of Nature is where we learn that warp drive is damaging the fabric of space-time itself. The spacefaring society that the Federation has cultivated is actually damaging space itself to the point where future space travel may not be possible in certain regions of space that have been over-traveled. And I like this episode in particular because of the environmental theme. This is just a fairly unsubtle direct metaphor for environmentalism, being careful with the resources that we have, that if we exhaust certain types of resources, whether it's petroleum, whether it's clean water, whatever it is, these are certain things that are not necessarily replaceable. And I like that Star Trek is trying to make an environmental message, and it's very much in line with other environmental episodes that you get in Star Trek or other instances of environmentalism in Star Trek. I'm thinking of like Star Trek IV with the Voyage Home, with the emphasis on saving the whales and environmentalism in that regard. But here we have an episode directly dealing with just depleting a resource that is irreplaceable, that enjoying the benefits of the spacefaring society. And there are benefits, right? You know, meeting new cultures, interplanetary trade and whatnot. These benefits are actually, they come at a cost. And I think any society is like that. You know, the modern society we live in, with all of its benefits, comes with a dark underside, and it damages the environment and certain resources that are irreplaceable. So I don't know if I have a lot deep to say about this episode, but I like that this episode is making an attempt to raise an environmental issue and then forces the viewer to ask the question, what is the price we're willing to pay for this modern society, this modern way of life we live in, this progressive way of life? It's not all roses and sunshine. That modernism and progressivism comes at a cost sometimes.
Yeah, I actually had this on my short list as I was putting my list together. It didn't make the final cut for me, but it was on my short list for the same reasons that you mentioned. And I, you know, obviously I have an interest in these episodes where we're dealing with environmental ethics. We actually tackle the topic of environmental ethics a great deal, Zachary, in Metatrex 22 down in Cetacean Ops, where we dive in a great deal into Star Trek IV and talk about George and Gracie. So this has been a topic that we've taken on. It's something that's, you know, near and dear to my heart. I think it's an important message that I think resonates with most of us. I mean, we all can identify with the limited nature of natural resources. And, you know, I love the way that Star Trek is able to take science fiction and tell a story that is relevant for our own culture without being confrontational with it, because this is a divisive topic in our society. I mean, we're very divisive in the United States on this topic in particular. I mean, so much so, there are two very distinct camps on this topic. It doesn't really matter where you stand on this. Star Trek is able to present this problem in a way that I think both camps can look at and understand and even compromise on. And I love the way that they were able to come up with a common sense compromise at the end of this episode. And it, for me, as someone who really enjoys the optimistic nature of Star Trek, for me, it provides a sense of hope that, you know, perhaps we can come up with some kind of similar compromise as we wrestle with the limited nature of our own natural resources here on planet Earth.
This is something I actually wanted to ask you about while we're talking about this episode. What did you think of the final compromise? I think it's interesting to me that they don't just ban warp travel outright, right? I mean, the pure environmental message would be, you know, put the brakes on. We have to be limited to our own solar system. We can't keep doing this spacefaring way of life that the Federation has cultivated. We're going to destroy the fabric of space time itself, and we have to put the brakes on. It's interesting to me that they don't take that radical of a solution. They seek a very practical compromise, putting a speed limit to warp 5 on warp travel, unless in extreme emergencies. I think they put it in the episode. I guess it's a question of cost and benefits. I think the perspective of the episode is that the benefits of that type of society outweigh the cost. And if you can limit the damage in some way, you know, if you're not going to have as radical of a solution as just eliminating the damage altogether and putting the brakes on that form of life, then what you can do is try to minimize the damage. And that seems to be just a very practical compromise at the end of the day. I can't imagine that that solution to the problem at the end of this episode is very appealing to, I would say, to extreme environmentalists or people for whom environmentalism is the primary motivating factor in how they think we should relate to the natural world.
To answer your question, I like the compromise at the end of this episode because it is just that. It's a compromise. Someone wants to find compromise as a solution that neither party's happy with. And so I think at the end of this episode, we had that type of resolution. I mean, neither camp was particularly happy with, you know, with the results, but they were both willing to live with it. Certainly, you know, Federation starships are going to have to deal with having to travel at, you know, really half their capable speed. And, you know, it wasn't quite the resolution that, you know, the scientists were looking for, because obviously their goal was to eliminate warp speed altogether. And the fact that Star Trek was willing to take this kind of risk. I mean, think about this for a second, Zachary. Warp travel is about as essential to Star Trek as it gets. So it was a really, really risky thing in my mind to, in some ways, make this form of travel taboo. I think that was a really risky thing. And I think it, for me, just accentuates the limited nature of our natural resources, because just as warp travel is essential in a Star Trek universe, things like coal and oil and, you know, these natural resources that we have are essential to our planet as well. So I think it was a really risky thing. I do like the compromise at the end of the episode. Another thing that I will say is I appreciated the fact that they, on a couple of occasions, and I think even in Nemesis, mentioned this limiting of warp speed, and the fact that at least on a couple of occasions they were given permission to exceed it. So I appreciate the fact that they just didn't, you know, this wasn't a resolution that just ended at the end of this episode. They actually thought to mention it a couple of other times in other episodes of Star Trek.
Yeah, I actually don't think of this as being as risky of a move dramatically as that. I sort of think Star Trek plays a little loosey-goosey with, you know, how fast warp drive really is and how long it takes to get in a particular place. And, you know, they can just say, we're going to go at warp 5 and it's going to take a certain amount of time to get there. And it doesn't seem to affect the drama of the story in any meaningful way, except for the fact that they keep calling back to it. Like, oh, it's an extreme emergency. And how do we know it's an extreme emergency? Well, we're authorized to exceed the warp speed limitation. So they can use it dramatically to like sort of escalate the seriousness of whatever situation they're in. It gives them a talking point to say, oh, this is a really extreme emergency. We can go at warp 9 today. In terms of the ethics of the episode, I think it's interesting that the episode pretty much takes a combination of utilitarianism and pragmatism. It basically does a cost-benefit analysis, the pros and benefits of being in the modern world and in a la Star Trek spacefaring modern world versus the costs and the damage that we're doing environmentally. And given that the extreme positions aren't very viable, you know, you can't turn back the time and say warp drive doesn't exist anymore, just like we can't turn the clock back and do without automobiles and gasoline and whatnot. Although, you know, hopefully we can find a better way to, meet our energy and travel needs at some point. But, you know, the basic idea is you can't turn the clock back. So given that, you know, a compromise position seems to be the most reasonable, and I just like the pragmatism of the solution at the end of the day, that at the end of the day, if we're going to have to stay in the middle, then we're going to reach a compromise that's not going to make anyone happy, but will at least minimize the damage. And of course, this is just an unsubtle reference to our own world, that we should be compromising, trying to minimize whatever damage we can do. And sadly, that doesn't happen in politics here in real life all the time necessarily, but this episode, I think you have to give it credit, because the episode could have taken a more extreme position. I think justifiably, a very Star Trek-y thing to do would be to mm-hmm. take a more extreme position and say, you know, this environmental damage to space-time in this case is really, really bad, so we need to put the brakes on altogether. And I would like to see that version where warp drive gets radically limited for the sake of preventing this damage altogether, and see what, you know, what would happen to Federation society in that situation. But I think the practical solution is the pragmatic one, and that's the position the episode takes at the end of the day.
I agree. Well, Zachary, the first episode on my list is Parallels. Parallels, of course, is the episode in which Worf is coming back to the Enterprise from a Batleth competition, and he finds himself shifting between parallel realities where things that are going on around him are different, but he's the only one who seems to notice the changes. And so we've actually talked about this episode a couple of times in on Metatrex. We've discussed it in terms of the physics and metaphysics of time. And I think that's probably one of the things that really I find attractive about this episode. I enjoy those time traveling episodes as episodes where we've somehow fractured the time space continuum. We're shifting between realities. I find those episodes appealing, and they raise all sorts of interesting questions for me. And it sends my mind wondering about the possibilities in our own universe and whether or not that there is a parallel reality going on that's, you know, veiled from my perception, you know, right alongside me. I found this intriguing. The way the different scenarios were playing out, each one was radically different. Worf was the only one who noticed those differences, but you know, each time, each action that he took in each reality, it sent the events spiraling off in different directions. I thought that was really interesting. But anytime we're dealing with the physics and metaphysics of time, I just find it fascinating.
So Parallels was also on my list, so I can cross that off my list as well. But I think what I love about Parallels is that it deals with a subject matter, the notion of an infinite number of parallel or possible universes, in a way that you don't get to deal with in very many stories, even in other Star Trek episodes where you get parallel universes. It's often something like the mirror universe or something like the Kelvin timeline, where there's a special universe for some particular reason, and a story is told in that alternate universe. And people who are interested in science fiction, people who are interested in philosophy, people who are well-read in this genre understand the idea that there are an infinite number of possible universes conceptually, right? That's something that I've known about for a long time, you've known about for a long time. But what I find interesting about this episode, I think this is something that the average viewer, the average maybe undergraduate philosophy student, maybe, you know, like an introduction to philosophy student, doesn't necessarily think about every day, right? This is something that your average viewer has to learn about, that, wow, maybe there is an infinite number of possible universes. How would we know? What would that be like? What would the relationship between those universes be? This isn't something your casual Star Trek fan is going to think about very much. So I love that this episode is kind of like an introduction to a sort of a crazy idea in metaphysics or in the metaphysics of time and space that you don't get a chance to tell a story like this very much. You know, most alternate universe episodes don't focus on that concept. And Star Trek found a way to get in there the very last season of The Next Generation. You know, Brannon Braga basically writes an episode dealing with this, you know, fairly esoteric idea that, you know, people who are interested in this genre are going to understand and identify with and find it really interesting. You get to see things on film you don't get to see very much, like the breakdown between, you know, the breakdown of the barriers between these universes. And again, your casual fan who's not interested in these topics necessarily hasn't thought about that before. And this is a way to kind of draw people into thinking about something, a philosophical issue that you just don't experience in daily life or in most dramatic TV episodes. And so I just love that this episode takes pains to deal with an issue in something so abstract as an infinite number of possible universes and try to find a way to show it on film.
Yeah. We actually talked about this episode in great depth in Metatrex 16 entitled All the Bubbles. We broke this down to a great degree. I have to say, one of the things that I really appreciated about this episode is that the experience that Worf has in seeing all of these other alternative possibilities, is it really opened his mind up to the possibilities that are that exist in his own life, in his in Prime Worf's life. And I really appreciate that. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not a fan of the Worf Troy relationship. I'm not in that camp. But I just appreciated the fact that he was able to really open his eyes to all of the possibilities that existed in his own life. And I really think that this was essential to the character of Worf, the experience that he had in seeing his life unfold in other ways, I think is really essential to who he is and who he, I think it informs who he becomes even later on when we see him in Deep Space Nine.
Well, Mike, there is a bit of an existentialist thread to this episode insofar as Worf seeing other possibilities for himself opens his eyes to what possibilities might be in his own universe, right? And I think that's the power of hypothetical thinking, counterfactual thinking, right? Things that are counter to the way things really are. You know, I think, you know, it raises these metaphysical issues like, are these parallel universes real? Do they really exist? What's the relationship between them? But then there's kind of the personal question of, you know, okay, what am I going to do in this universe, given that there are possibilities for the way things could unfold? And I think this episode is, you know, while that's not necessarily the focus of the episode, that is important for Worf's character development. And it's present in the episode. You know, that's part of the power of counterfactual reasoning that our species seems to be able to do.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, Zachary, what's next on your list?
Okay, so next on my list is Inheritance.
Oh, okay.
Is that on your list too?
No, it wasn't.
Okay, so Inheritance, if you remember, is the episode in which a woman comes on board claiming to be Data's mother. Juliana Tainer is her name.
I love the episode, though.
It's a great episode, and it's funny that you didn't make your list.
Yeah, anything that has Fiona Flanagan in it, I love it.
I actually think of this as kind of the low-hanging fruit in terms of philosophy in Season 7 of The Next Generation. But to make a long story short, she doesn't know that she's really an android, that the real Juliana Tainer was killed and that Dr. Noonien Sung created another version of her in android form. And she is essentially, styled herself to be Data's mother. And philosophically, there are just a couple of things that I like about this episode. The first one is I think it raises this issue of the Turing test for artificial intelligence. How do you know that an artificial being is genuinely intelligent? And here we have a very, very, very plausible candidate for a being that is passing the Turing test. If you remember, the Turing test is if you can communicate with a being long enough, in some sort of a blind fashion where you don't know whether the interlocutor that you're communicating with is an artificially intelligent computer or a real life, human intelligence, then for all intents and purposes, you have just as much reason for thinking that the artificial intelligence is intelligent as the genuine human being. And here we have a being that comes on board and genuinely fools everyone, right? No one at first can distinguish any of her reactions from genuine human behavior. Even she herself thinks she's a human, right? She's programmed to think that she's human, and she doesn't know she's an android. So right across the board, it seems to just pass the Turing test better than anything we've seen in Star Trek. Better than Data, better than the Doctor. You know, this is a being that is the only tell, and this is an interesting part of the episode, I think. The only tell that she is not a genuine human being, that she's an artificially intelligent being, is the pattern of her eye blinking. Her eyes blink in a Fourier pattern, which Data claims is the same pseudo-random process that causes his own eye blinking. And he recognizes that and realizes that she is an android. And for me, this actually raises the deepest part of this episode. It's one thing if the being can pass the Turing test. You know, if any being has been able to pass the Turing test, like I said, I think it's Juliana Tainer, better than anyone in Star Trek. But isn't it just as plausible to say, look, hey, if something like her eye blinking, the randomness of her eye blinking is actually pseudo-randomness caused by an algorithm that's complex that creates the appearance of randomness to humans, can't you say that about every other aspect of her behavior or Data's behavior? Anything that looks like spontaneity or creativity or genuine free will, aren't those things just pseudo-random behavior caused by whatever algorithms are happening inside that positronic brain? So I think this raises the skepticism of artificial intelligence and the skepticism of machine free will If it's possible to interpret anything that looks to humans like randomness as a type of algorithm, then why can't you say that about any type of being that's artificially created, Data or the Doctor or Juliana Tainer? And worst case scenario, can't you say that about us? If all of our behavior is just pseudo-random behavior being controlled by whatever processes are happening inside of our brain, doesn't that really undermine our notion of free will?
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. You and I had this conversation, last week when we were recording. We were talking about how as we get older, we find ourselves, each of us, emulating the mannerisms and behaviors of our fathers. And the thing that I find interesting about that is, at least in my case, I didn't know my father very well. And so when I do see those mannerisms pop up, the only explanation that I really have is something written in my genetic code that predisposes me to those behaviors. So that causes me to wonder just how random the rest of my behavior is. Is it something that I'm predisposed to, or do I really have free will? So that definitely, I think, is at the heart of what's going on here with Juliana Tainer. Another thing you mentioned, her creative abilities. Like Data, she is very accomplished with a violin. And as my memory serves, that was another means for which Data was able to quantify his theory that she was an artificial life form, because both her performances were completely identical.
Yeah, and of course, no human being could really do that. So I think this gets to the heart of the issues in this episode. If it's possible to interpret every single behavior in the case of artificially created beings, if it's possible to interpret that behavior as being produced by the algorithms that are generated inside whatever systems they're made of, positronic brains or whatnot, then it sure looks like anything that looks like free will or artificial intelligence is really just pseudo free will or pseudo artificial intelligence. It has the illusion of having those properties, but really is just produced by those algorithms. And in the case of us, I think you can give the same sort of biological reading. You know, can't you interpret human behavior or human responses or human intelligence as just being a function of whatever's going on inside of our brains that's not under our control? So I like this episode because it deals with this issue of artificial intelligence, but I think maybe the deeper point that I'm getting at in this episode is that it really undermines our notion of free will for us here in general. And I guess that's the $64,000 question. You know, can we reduce this kind of higher level behavior to lower level properties? You know, in our case, it would be properties of whatever's going on in our neurons in our brain. In the case of Juliana Tainer or Data, it would be, you know, lower level properties in terms of what's going on in their positronic brain. Can you take higher level behavior and reduce that behavior to whatever's happening at the lower level, essentially eliminating the higher level entities and the higher level descriptions and the higher level properties from our account of what is actually real?
Yeah. I remember the first time I saw this episode, I have to say that I was actually surprised that she ended up being a Soong android. And so that was a big twist for me. But I think you're right. And looking at this complex debate between the ideas of free will and a sense of determinism, if our listeners want to hear more about that, a real throwback here, Zachary, you have to go all the way back to episode 1 and 2 of Metatrex.
That's pretty far back at this point. This is episode 40, so that's right out of the gate for us.
That is right out of the gate. So, but they're there. If our listeners want to hear us talk in depth about the topics of free will and determinism. All right, Zachary, next on my list, I have Journey's End. And again, this is an episode that we just talked about to some degree in Metatrex 35, entitled Wesley's Inferno. A couple of things that really capture my attention in this particular episode, Journey's End, is the idea of human rights. This episode parallels a very dark chapter in American history in which we've come to know it as the Trail of Tears, when thousands of Native Americans were rounded up and marched to reservations by the military. And here we're on a planet out on the frontier, and an agreement has been reached between the Federation and the Cardassians, and that agreement causes the forced relocation of this settlement, surprisingly enough, of Native Americans, if you will, to another colony. But they're not so interested in leaving. So I found that very interesting. There's a lot of social political philosophy. There are some things here I think that would parallel Rousseau's ideas on common good. I think there's just a lot of really interesting philosophical content in this episode, apart from really what we talked about in Wesley's Inferno.
It's interesting. This episode made my list as well. So again, I can check another one off my list here. I put it on my list for slightly different reasons that I'm going to talk about in a minute, but I do want to speak to your point of the ethical issues going on in Journey's End. I think regardless of what your intuitions are, if you think it's wrong for the Federation to relocate these Native Americans and basically, you know, hand their planet over to the Cardassians, then the burden is to explain why exactly you think that's wrong. And likewise, if you fall on the other side, if you're appealing to something like common good and you think, well, we have to do that because of this treaty and because, you know, the common good of the majority of the people in the Federation depends on making these kinds of agreements. You know, there's a burden, I think, whichever side you fall on, there's a burden to explain what exactly is going on. This, in my mind, this episode takes a fairly utilitarian mm-hmm. stance on the issue, that more people are going to benefit from this treaty and fewer people are going to be harmed if we make the exchange and hand the planet over and relocate the Native Americans. That's a small price to pay for the greater good. So that general utilitarian point seems to be what happens at the end of the day. On the other hand, if you think it's wrong, you can say, well, why exactly? I think it goes against our intuitions. There's a sentimentalism to it that, you know, it's wrong to take someone's property. It's wrong to forcibly relocate people. But why exactly is it wrong? So the burden there philosophically is to give some sort of account of why that's wrong. And the thing that comes to my mind is just straight up Kantian ethics, that if you treat other people as means to an end, then you're not treating people with respect. You're not treating people as autonomous beings, just like you are. And you're essentially using people as tools at that point to achieve some other end, rather than treating people with mutual respect. And so there's this Kantian interpretation of this, but and frankly, a sentimental interpretation, right? I think it moves me at some sort of deep sentimental level. Like, it's just wrong, and my gut tells me that's wrong. But that's not much of a philosophical answer. I think the stronger answer is probably to say that, look, you're essentially treating other people as tools and not letting them be autonomous beings and make decisions for themselves. You're using them as a means to an end rather than treating them as an end in themselves. That's pretty much what Kant would say about the situation, but... Is there anything else? I mean, is this just a straight up, you know, utilitarianism versus Kantian ethics dilemma, or is there something else going on that makes this a more interesting scenario than that?
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. Let me say that there are some really interesting things going on here in terms of Wesley's journey of his own person, you know, discovering his own personal identity. But the overall story arc, I think you hit the nail on the head. And, you know, you're dealing with human rights, you're dealing with utilitarianism, Kantian ethics, you know, the social political philosophies that are at work here in this episode. It's really, really rich. I love the fact that they were able to invoke a little bit of real history. Anytime that they can call back to real historical events and they can kind of root an episode of Star Trek in something that is actual. For me as a fan, Zachary, that just puts a whole other layer on top of it and just makes it that, you know, that much more interesting to me. They mentioned the Pueblo Revolt of, I think it was 1680. And so, you know, they're kind of adding this whole layer that really roots the Star Trek universe in our own. And so that just adds a whole other layer that interests me.
Well, it's easy to forget that our history is also their history, right? You know, it's just a little farther in the future, but anything that's happened in our past also happened in their past. And it's fun to see threads from our own history continue to be relevant, you know, 300 or 400 years in the future. But I actually really like the existential journey that Wesley Crusher is on in this episode, because I think this is something, and maybe it's just me getting older, but I think as I get older, I find I appreciate these existential issues more than when I was younger, because I think you only have so much time in life, and every moment of every day, you have to ask yourself, what do I want to be doing today or this week or this year? What projects do I want to work on? What values do I want to have? And Wesley Crusher comes to realize that he's been on a path that is not meant for him. And it takes the influence of the traveler. It takes, you know, coming back and seeing a glimpse at his past life on the Enterprise, and all of these factors come together and basically make him realize that he's not been the authentic version of himself, and the authentic version of himself belongs somewhere else. And that's a hard realization for anyone to make. And we get to see Wesley Crusher make, a decision like that with the help of the traveler in this episode. And I just find that more interesting as I get older, because you only get so much time and you only get to be on so many paths. And the worst thing you could do is be stuck on a path that is not meant for you for too long. You could waste your entire life that way. And it's rejuvenating to see someone like Wesley Crusher, who's so the poster child for wanting to go to Starfleet Academy, right?
Yes.
You know, he's following in his father's footsteps. He's got Captain Picard as an idol. And here we get to see Wesley Crusher, take a leap of faith, pardon the pun, into a different realm, a different way of life, a different possibility for himself. And that's a scary situation for anyone to be in. But we get to see Wesley Crusher do that. And I just find that more interesting the older I get.
I concur 100%. And again, we talked about this in Metatrex 35, Wesley's Inferno, and that really is a strong theme in this episode. But that almost seems to be a B plot.
It's one of these cases of the episode trying to do too much, right? You have two philosophically interesting plots going on at the same time, and they compete with each other for attention.
Yeah, I agree completely. That title, Journey's End, I was going to say, Zachary, that it kind of speaks to Wesley's story in this episode more so than the other story. But you're right. I think you have two really strong plots with very rich content competing here. And it is, it's almost trying to do, because you could really pull these out and to tell two completely separate stories. And they would both be home runs, by the way.
And I would actually argue that the existential journey of self-discovery, the issue of authenticity, is actually a bit more pervasive in this episode than purely being limited to Wesley Crusher. You get the Native Americans being authentic in their desire to follow their own path, even regardless of the consequences. And that's a difficult choice to make for them. It puts themselves in harm's way, but it's who they are and what they value. And that's a choice that they have to make. Captain Picard has to decide, which path does he follow? Does he, do what Starfleet tells him to do? Does he violate his orders, like you've seen him do in other cases, for the sake of doing something that his conscience thinks is the right thing to do? And Captain Picard has to follow along somewhere along that line too. And he doesn't get to be neutral and abstain from making a choice about what values matter to him most. So I kind of think of this episode, person by person, group by group inside this episode, everyone is forced to make a choice about what values they prioritize and what factors influence the decisions that they're going to make. And this forces the issue of personal responsibility for those choices. Captain Picard doesn't get to just say, oh, I'm just following orders. He's got to wrestle with it. And the Native Americans don't just get to say, oh, we're just going to stay on this planet because that's who we are. They have to wrestle with the decision. We get to see everyone wrestling with the consequences of their choices. We get to see them wrestling with the reasons for their choices. We get to see them wrestling with how they're going to interact with other groups and relate to each other. And so this episode really emphasizes personal responsibility straight across the board, I think.
Oh, I agree. So by my count, Zachary, you and I have matched up on Parallels and Journey's End. You've also given us Force of Nature and Inheritance. You have one more. Do you want to go ahead and tell us, or do you want to hold on to it and wait around?
I'll wait around. I've covered four. You've covered two, right?
All right. Well, I'm going to give you an obvious one. Because I think the philosophical story is right there in the title of the episode, and that is Emergence. I love this episode, not because it's a particularly well-written episode. I think some of the holodeck scenes on the train kind of become a bit of a tedium, but this idea of the emerging consciousness, the child, if you will, that the computer is giving birth to, and the responsibility that the crew of the Enterprise takes in bringing that new life into the universe, and the trust that they have in letting that life emerge and go out into the universe. I just, this is really fascinating for a lot of reasons. I think it does deal with this idea of emerging consciousness that I find so fascinating. Is our conscious nature something that emerges? Is it something that is inherently part of us in a physical or metaphysical way? Or you know, are we dealing with, you know, some kind of dualistic idea where the mind and the body, or the soul and the body, are separated? I think this deals with a lot of really interesting ideas, and the fact that out of this piece of technology comes a sentient being. I think it's fascinating. It's something that's been the stuff of great science fiction for many, many years.
So Mike, this also made my list. So this is my last pick on my list, but I also thought I would save the best for last. And I put this on my list last. It's actually number 5 on my list, in the interest of saving the best for last, but not because it's the best episode of Star Trek. The episode fails dramatically for me in a few ways. It's actually a bit of a tedious episode to watch, I think, but I put it on my list as the best of the best in terms of Star Trek's ability to raise philosophical issues in season 7 of TNG. Because this is an issue, the question of emergence is a question that comes up in almost every area of thought, no matter what your interests are, whether it's history or psychology or sociology, almost any area of study or chemistry or physics. Every area of thought deals with this question of emergent properties. You know, what is the relationship between higher level properties and lower level properties? Mm-hmm. Is it possible for a complex arrangement of basic parts to manifest emergent behavior that is unpredictable and novel and not just reducible to the behavior of those lower level parts? You could potentially explain consciousness that way. You can explain the behavior of complex systems in this way. A simple way of thinking about what emergence really means. It's an example I like to think about is the relationship between say water molecules, H2O molecules, mm-hmm. and the higher level property of wetness. You know, water as an aggregate of H2O molecules manifesting certain properties. If you take any one of those H2O molecules, one H2O molecule is not wet. It's just a molecule, right? But you put enough of them together and you get this emergent property, wetness, that is not purely predictable based on the nature of an individual component that makes up that system. And so if you think of all of reality as being hierarchical in that way, small things get put together into large things, and those sized objects, you know, you can kind of go down the list, right? You can have, you know, subatomic particles, and those form atoms, and you put atoms together and you get molecules. You put molecules together and you get compounds. You put compounds together, you get you know, fairly simple things. Eventually you get life. You get organisms like cells. Put enough cells together and you get complex organisms, lower level complex organisms, higher level complex organisms, or even more complex, have more cells with more complex structures. So all of reality seems to be built in this hierarchical sense. And at every level, higher level structures seem to manifest behavior and patterns and have properties that you don't see at the lower levels. So then the question is, what's the relationship between them? Are those higher level properties purely and totally explainable in terms of lower level properties, so much so that we should try to eliminate those higher level objects from our vocabulary? You know, can you take a high level structure like a society, something that sociology would study? Can you reduce that behavior to psychology, the behavior and concepts that apply to an individual in that society? Can you take a person's psychology and reduce their behavior and the concept of a person to concepts that you get in neuroscience, you know, purely what's going on in the brain, biochemically? Can you take all of that and reduce it to chemistry? Can you take all of that and reduce it to physics? So why do we need these higher level descriptions? So emergence is basically the claim that at every higher level, you get new properties, new behaviors that are manifested that are not totally explainable in terms of what's going on at the lower level. They strike us as novel and interesting and surprising. When you get a new arrangement of simple properties, you get something new that was unpredictable that you couldn't have foreseen. And we can learn something about the natural world by seeing these new arrangements. And that seems to be what's going on in this episode. Yes. That the Enterprise computer, something has happened where a certain structure, a certain degree of complexity has manifested itself in some emergent behavior that was unpredictable and unforeseen, maybe even a new form of life. But this is the $64,000 question. Is this genuinely an emergent intelligence and an emergent life form? Or is this just, you know, a function of whatever's happening at the lower level? And you can ask that question of any discipline, regardless of anything, in any subject area, any area of thought. You can say, are these the entities and the structures and the concepts of those disciplines genuinely emergent and genuinely analyzable in their own right? Or are they just reducible to whatever's happening at the lower level? And so that distinction between reductionism and emergence is, in my mind, one of the core philosophical questions in our understanding of the natural mm-hmm. world. And it speaks to whether we're going to retain these notions of consciousness and free will and psychology and sociology, you know, these higher level sciences, or whether eventually, as we learn more and more and more about the lower level natural world through chemistry and physics and whatnot, whether we'll be able to take all of those higher level concepts and explain them away. You know, in the future, will we say things like, you know, rather than saying I'm in pain or I have a certain emotion or society is having a certain property, will we just say things like, well, my C fibers are firing today, and that's all I need to say to convey what's going on? Is it literally that simple? Where this higher level talk that we have to describe ourselves and describe society and describe the natural world, is all of that just reducible to lower level stuff? It strikes us as wrong. I think we lose something in our description of the world. We lose the richness of these higher level structures when we try to do that. And philosophically, I just don't know which way it's going to turn out. So I think of this as one of the open questions in our understanding of the natural world. It speaks to consciousness. It speaks to philosophy of science. And regardless of what your interests are, this is a concept that is directly relevant to what you're studying and what your interests are. So I put it at the top of my list just because I think that this speaks to the core of our understanding of reality way more so than any of the other philosophical issues we've talked about in this season.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And for me, this episode is really quintessential Star Trek in that it raised the questions, but it didn't really answer the question in any real sense. In fact, it was almost too easy for them to kind of come to the conclusion that this was, you know, this was an emerging consciousness, you know, coming from the computer. This is a new form of life. And, you know, they pointed to the fact that it sure seemed to be displaying free will, and it sure seemed to be, you know, these higher levels of behavior, and it sure seems to be there. And so it must be this new form of life, and, you know, we're going to help it along. We're not going to fight it. We're, you know, we're Starfleet officers. You know, our primary mission is to seek out new life. And so, you know, we're not going to interfere. to me, it was almost a little too easy. But again, just the fact that Star Trek found a new way to tell a very old story in the science fiction genre, I found it fascinating. And the fact that this emerging consciousness was able to utilize the holodeck. So we were using the holodeck to really tell the story. And I, you know, again, Star Trek does that very well and raising these questions, but not really giving us any quantifiable answers.
Well, that's something that season 7 of TNG seems to do really well. In at least two instances, I'm thinking of Parallels and Emergence, you get an attempt to portray visually something that is highly abstract philosophically. And that's hard to do. Like, you take a concept like an infinite number of possible worlds. How do you show that on screen? Take a concept like emergent properties. Okay, how do you show that on screen? It's a very interesting filmmaking challenge to take something that is inherently not visible and find a way to make it visible, you know, for dramatic purposes. But I think, you know, you mentioned something that strikes me as interesting. You mentioned that the crew of the Enterprise kind of leaps to the conclusion that the computer is now a new life form. There's an emergent life form that's happening. Where are the skeptics saying, wait a minute, it's just a computer glitch. Why are we overthinking this, right? And can't you say the same thing about us? You know, we sort of think, oh, well, we're intelligent, we're sentient, we have emergent mental properties, you know, arising out of whatever's happening in our brain, kind of emerging out of whatever physical processes are at the lower level. Why isn't that some sort of just an accidental computer glitch? Why is it something? why is it something to treat with the reverence that happens in Star Trek if it's just reducible to the lower level anyway? I just kind of wonder where the skeptics are in this episode.
Yeah, because you have to know that somewhere there is a junior officer that just got out of the academy, and he's just full of all kinds of academic information, and you know, he's ready with a textbook answer to what's going on here, and you don't really see that. It's Geordi and his PowerPoint, and a little bit of psychobabble from Troy, and you know, certainly Data's going to support this, because after all, he's a sentient being that was once considered an artificial life form.
Well, while we're talking about emergence, this is something that I think is really worth keeping in mind, that one of the distinctive characteristics of emergence as a philosophical theory versus other types of physicalist theories, there are other types of physicalist theories that allow for higher level physical properties. The thing that makes emergence unique is that it basically says those higher level properties are novel and unpredictable, and that you can't, even in principle, reduce those higher level properties to something at the lower level. It grants that they're physical properties. It just says the properties that emerge and the behavior that emerges is in principle, not even in practice. I mean, there's a difference between emergence theory and, say, chaos theory. Chaos theory would say complex systems are just unpredictable, not because they're in principle unpredictable. It's that there's so many factors to take into account, you practically can't take them all into account. Emergence says something a little bit different than that. Emergence basically says the move from, say, an H2O molecule to the behavior of water as an aggregate, mm-hmm. with its higher level properties like wetness, you would never have predicted the behavior, the emergence of the property of wetness based on analyzing individual H2O molecules. You put enough of those together and you get the behavior of cells and things like that. And at every level, there's a novelness and an unpredictability to it. You know, new properties literally kind of emerge out of nothing when these aggregates are put together. And you often don't know what those properties are going to be until the aggregates are formed, until those complex structures, you know, happen. So emergence, you know, the name emergence, I think, is a good name for the theory. You know, new properties kind of emerge, mm-hmm. out of lower level properties, but it's not that those higher level properties are just reducible to those lower level properties. They're genuinely novel, qualitatively distinct types of properties that only happen in complex aggregates.
And I think sometimes that's one of the things that I find really leaves me puzzled sometimes, because at the end of the day, I think just about any behavior can be reducible to something.
Yeah, and that's the thing that's so weird about emergence theory, because on the one hand, you say, okay, well, take the water and the wetness thing. There's nothing else there besides water molecules. Mm-hmm. There's no spooky metaphysical dualism, no other kinds of entities. It is just H2O molecules. It's just that when you put them together in a certain kind of way, you get a new property that wasn't there before, wetness, right? And so it does seem like something qualitatively different has emerged out of that. But at the same time, you can think, wait a minute, you can almost talk yourself out of it. Wait a minute. It's still just H2O molecules. Why are we overthinking this? Mm-hmm. And you can say the same thing. Now, take that as a simple example. Now run consciousness with it. Okay, well, consciousness, that's emerged out of whatever's happening in our brain, right? Complex neural structures and whatnot, and consciousness emerges. Well, it sure seems like it's qualitatively distinct. I have subjective experience, I have intentions, I have thoughts, I have feelings, all of this rich mental language that describes the kind of being that we are. Well, then you can go, wait a minute, isn't all of that just whatever's going on in the brain? Can't you sort of talk yourself out of the existence of those higher level structures? Then you just go, it just flies in the face of all of our experience, right? Wait a minute, well, I am conscious. I do have thoughts. I do have intentions. How can you say those things aren't real in some way? So, you know, what I think you don't want to do is be an eliminativist, where you try to eliminate the higher level structures. Right. Like you wouldn't say wetness doesn't exist, right? You just say, yeah, wetness just is a certain aggregate of H2O molecules. And you put them together in a certain way, and there is a new property that emerges in aggregate, but it's not spooky. It's not metaphysical. You know, it is emergent, but it's still a richly physicalist theory. It's not dualist, and it's not metaphysical. And I think that's a common misunderstanding of emergence theory too. Emergence theory does not say some new kind of entity emerges. And yet that is what's going on, because if higher level properties do exist, you know, wetness is a property of water, and water does exist as a higher level structure. So it's a question of, in my mind, of ontology. If you want to make a list of, you know, what things exist in reality, do you include all the higher level structures, or is it just the lower level entities and properties? And I think emergence theory leans a little bit more towards saying that higher level entities and higher level properties exist, and they're qualitatively distinct, and you have to add them to your ontology. In other words, you have to add them to the list of beings that exist in the world. So not only are there atoms and molecules, but there are cells, and there aren't just cells. There are organs. There aren't just organs. There are organisms, and there aren't just organisms. There are societies, right? And all of those things exist. And at every level, you get qualitatively distinct behavior. And so one consequence of this, just to belabor the talking about emergence, because I find it so richly interesting. The one consequence of this is that each level of science is qualitatively distinct from lower level sciences that have their own entities and their own properties to study, and you can't reduce those to lower level properties. So, you know, if you really wanted to be a reductionist and say that higher level stuff is just reducible to lower level stuff, you're talking about eliminating sociology and eliminating psychology and eliminating biochemistry, and it ultimately just slides all the way down to the lowest level of physics. But, you know, if emergence theory or something like emergence theory is true, that means at every higher level, you get distinct behaviors and distinct entities, all of which are real, all of which aren't an illusion. They're not reducible to what's happening at the lower level. And the objects of study of those sciences are worth studying in their own right. So the goal is not just to eliminate them and explain their behavior in that way, but to study them in their own right based on the new and novel behaviors and properties that the entities in those theories and those fields of study are focused on.
Yeah, outstanding. Well, Zachary, you have exhausted your list of five. You've got a couple of honorable mentions that we'll get to. I actually have two more on my list because Parallels, Journeys End, Emergence were three on my list that you and I both had on our list. So I've got two left here, and I'll hit them really fast. All Good Things on my list because, again, physics and metaphysics of time, I won't belabor that at all. And I will say that, as we've mentioned before, on Metatrex 18, The Poker Game of Life, we deal with a little bit of game theory here in this episode as well. I couldn't put a list of five philosophical essentials without having All Good Things on there.
I don't want to slide by All Good Things, because that is a very interesting episode to me, but for slightly different reasons. I think the idea of humanity being on trial from the beginning of the next generation to the end of the next generation,
yes,
is a, I don't know if I'd call it a philosophical theme, but it's at least an important theme of the next generation. And what it does is sort of put the mirror back at the viewer, back at humanity in general, and say, what kind of being are we? What kind of being do we want to be? How do we present ourselves to each other? How do we present ourselves to the world at large? If we end up being a spacefaring society at some point, how do we present ourselves in that world? And it just sort of puts the mirror smack back at humanity and forces the question, what is human nature and what are we going to be like going into the future? And I love that the next generation starts with that question and bookends itself in the last episode, All Good Things, with that very question.
Yeah, I agree 100%. In fact, I will give it to Rick Berman and everyone involved with Star Trek The Next Generation. That idea was well preserved, even though we didn't really visit it very often. The idea of humanity on trial, it's fascinating to me because I don't feel like we ever got away from it. They did a really good job of weaving that in without really even bringing it up over the course of the seven seasons. And to book in this series, you're 100% correct.
Mike, you just don't get it. The trial never ends. Don't you get it?
The trial never ends, Captain. Boy, Capitan. Indeed, indeed. Well, the other episode on my list is Homeward. I know this isn't a particular fan favorite, but I have to say, Zachary, that this idea of moral relativism versus the Prime Directive is fascinating. One of the things that draws me to Star Trek, at least in terms of the philosophical themes, are these moral plays. I really appreciate these kind of ethical deep dives that Star Trek is willing to take. And I think this is really one of the best of those, because we took something sacred in the Star Trek universe, the Prime Directive, and we really gave it a challenge. And this is really one of the best challenges, I think, in all of Star Trek to the Prime Directive. We find right here in this episode. Do we do something very Kantian? Do we help these people? Or, you know, do we hold fast to that principle of the Prime Directive and let them die? And so Nikolai Rozhenko, Worf's adopted brother, has decided to throw the Prime Directive out the door, to put it out the airlock, and he is going to help these people. And he really causes a lot of trouble in the process of doing it.
You know, it's funny, Mike, because I think we've talked about a lot of threads in today's episode of Metatrex. We've talked about moral dilemmas. We've talked about existentialism and personal responsibility and other themes and in other episodes. But here, I think you get a really strong juxtaposition of those principles. There is the utilitarian principle, right? The greatest good for the greatest number. And then there's the Kantian approach, a rule-based approach. Do you save lives whenever you can because that's a rule? Or do you not violate your oath to uphold the Prime Directive if you're a member of Starfleet, because that's a rule? You have a case of conflicting rules for sure. I think you have conflicting values and conflicting principles, and that's interesting to see. But the fact that someone like Worf's brother is willing to not even break a rule, because he's not a member of Starfleet, so he's not bound to the Prime Directive to the degree that members of Starfleet are, right? He's not a Starfleet officer. I mean, presumably everyone in the Federation is bound under the Prime Directive to some degree. This is an interesting question, maybe for Larry Nemechek, right? To what extent is the Prime Directive just limited to Starfleet personnel, and to what extent does it apply to Federation citizens at large? Is it one of their founding principles? That kind of thing. But I love episodes like this where someone takes it upon themselves to just own the situation and say, I'm going to make a moral choice and say, I just can't live with myself if I let these people die. So I'm going to take an action. And if it means I violate a rule, that's fine. If I have to live with the consequences and something disastrous happens, that's fine. But I can't live with myself if I don't act. And that is, to me, is kind of the fundamental existentialist insight that no matter which side you fall on, you have to make a choice. If you're choosing to follow the Prime Directive, you're making a choice. You could have made the other choice. If you're choosing to violate the Prime Directive and take an action and save people, that's a choice. You could have made the other choice. No matter where you fall, no matter which, end of the spectrum, no matter which philosophical theory you're kind of analyzing the situation with, ultimately, like with all moral dilemmas, at a certain point, it just comes down to personal responsibility and personal values and choice, and you have to own the situation. And it's too easy to let principles or consequences, any of these sort of philosophical concepts, be an excuse not to act. And I just love the sheer energy of Worf's brother in this. He refuses to appeal to worry about rules. He refuses to worry about consequences. He is going to do the authentic thing that he decides to own, regardless of what consequences ensue, because that's who he is and what he thinks is the right thing to do. And he just owns it in some very personal, authentic way.
Yeah, I love the argument that Nikolai and Worf have. He says, I wasn't going to let those people die just because your captain started quoting Federation dogma to me. And Worf says to him, your duty was to respect the captain's order and to uphold the Prime Directive. Nikolai says, duty? That's all that really matters to you, isn't it? Well, I refuse to be bound by an abstraction. And I really think that was a defining conversation in this episode, because, you know, and there was a scene on the bridge in which, Picard says, well, this is one of those times when we have to face the ramifications of the Prime Directive and honor the lives which we cannot save. And Nikolai says, I don't find any honor in this whatsoever. He says, forgive me if I don't stay. And of course, he's got to go make preparations in the holodeck to do what he's going to do.
I think you're seeing the dark underbelly of Kantian ethics. You're seeing a case where someone is appealing to rules and principles,
yes,
and in irony quotes, dogma as an excuse not to act. No one wants to see these people die. Captain Picard doesn't want to see it. Worf doesn't want to see it, right? Everyone's compassionate. No one wants to see these people harmed. And yet, you know, from the perspective of Worf's brother, they're hiding behind rules, right? The rules are an excuse not to act, and it's harder to act. And that's the problem with Kantian ethics. You can appeal to the rule, but ultimately you have to make a choice. Do you follow the rule? Or do you not follow the rule? So the presence of moral principles, moral rules doesn't get you off the hook for owning the situation and making a choice one way or the other. And it's very easy to let rules and principles get you off the hook for your own actions.
Yeah, and I think this is a very relevant message for our world today. This is, again, one of the things I think that makes Star Trek so far ahead of any other science fiction franchise out there is we have a message here that is as relevant today as it was the day, you know, the writer put pen to paper and put this concept out there to begin with. It's such an important message for us to sit back and really consider the rules that we have and how they apply to the people in our society. And, you know, where do we draw the line and say, okay, these are the rules, and, you know, where do we find the grace, if you will, to bend them? You're right. You're absolutely right. This is the dark underbelly of Kantian ethics at work here, using the Prime Directive as an excuse not to act. And what I appreciate about Nikolai is he is, albeit he is somewhat misguided, and he kind of goes into this half-cocked. But the thing that I appreciate about him is that he is willing to put himself out there and to really put his future on the line to do what he feels in his heart is right, morally acceptable. And I appreciate that about him. And I think in the end, Worf really comes to appreciate that about him as well.
Well, I think it's a fine line between following a rule purely out of duty, purely because it's a rule. And this is Kant's point, that true moral worth comes from following rules out of a sense of duty, out of a sense of responsibility to doing the right thing. And he thinks if you're not doing those things out of duty, then your actions don't really have moral worth. It is actually following the rule out of a sense of duty that matters for Kant. But there's a difference between that, merely following a rule because of duty, and following a rule because you've made a choice that those are the values that matter to you. And Captain Picard does that when he chooses to follow the Prime Directive. He's not just going, oh, it's a rule, it's the right thing to do. He mm-hmm. really believes in the rule, and he's made a choice to own that rule and make that a part of his own moral code, his own philosophy, his own worldview, his own being, his own sense of self. So I don't think you can point to Captain Picard and say Captain Picard is merely following a rule and is using it as an excuse. Captain mm-hmm. Picard has made the other choice. He's made a choice that rule matters more than the consequences of violating that rule. And he's become comfortable with that so much so that he can go, yeah, it's a terrible situation, but it's what I'm going to do because I really believe in this rule. Mm-hmm. So, but I do think that you can imagine a situation when someone is being lazy or cowardice, and they just say, oh, I'm not going to act, it's this rule, and it's easier not to intervene and whatnot. But I don't think that's not most of the people on the Enterprise, right? If anyone, right? Everyone on the Enterprise, when they choose to follow the Prime Directive, it's because they have thought about it, they have wrestled with the moral issues, and they have owned it in some sort of authentic way. But I guess my point is just that, you know, appealing to the rule never solves the issue. It's up to the individual people to decide, you know, is the rule worth following or not? And, you know, what am I going to do about it if so or if not? And, you know, the presence of a rule doesn't get you off the hook one way or the other.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Zachary, you've got a couple of honorable mentions. Do you want to honorably mention them?
Yeah, I'm going to do this really, really quickly. So my first honorable mention is the Pegasus.
Okay.
And I like that episode mainly because of the sense of conflicting loyalties. Riker has a duty to his current captain. He has a sense of loyalty to his former captain, and you get a sense of just conflicting duties. He's got, it's not clear at the end of the day, which is the fundamental loyalty or which direction you should go because of that. And I think this is a feature of Kantian ethics too, that sometimes our moral principles and our, you know, insofar as we just mentioned that Kant's moral theory is one of duty, right? You do things because of a duty to the right thing to do, to the, what he calls the categorical imperative, these things that are necessary, that are imperatives that we should follow regardless of the consequences and regardless of the individual situations. But sometimes they conflict with each other, and what do you do in those cases? And I just like seeing Riker wrestle with a case of conflicting duties in a very personal, individual level. My second honorable mention is, I would say this is probably the least interesting of the honorable mentions, frankly, but I want to mention it. Firstborn. So if you remember, Firstborn is the episode where an older version of Alexander from the future, who's calling himself Kimtar, comes back in time to try to turn his younger self into a stronger warrior to try to prevent the death of Worf, of his father, at some future point. And I put this on the list mainly because it's just a straight up time travel paradox, like you get in many other time travel stories. It's interesting philosophically. What does this mean about the nature of time travel and the metaphysics of time and whatnot? I don't know if the episode says anything really unique or different about that issue, but I just like that season 7 of TNG all the way around is trying to deal with these, you know, fairly abstract issues in metaphysics, like parallels, like emergence, mm-hmm. and now the issue of time travel. But this, again, is not a terribly interesting version of this. It's a straight up grandfather paradox. What happens if you go back in time and change the past in some way? Won't that prevent your future self from having the need to go back in time? You know, it's like if you go back in time and shoot your grandfather, right? You're not going to grow up and you're not going to be born and have the chance to go back and shoot your grandfather. This is just another version of that. If Alexander becomes a young Alexander becomes a warrior as a result of his older influence on himself, then he won't grow up and have the need to go back in time to do that in the first place. So what does that mean for the metaphysics of time? You know, you can explain it in a lot of different ways, branching theories of time. Maybe you can say time travel is not possible as a result of these kinds of paradoxes. Mm-hmm. Again, the episode is not terribly interesting, doesn't have a whole lot to say about it, but it does a good job of raising the discussion of the metaphysics of time and time travel. So I put it on the list as an honorable mention, but of everything we've talked about, I sort of think of that as the least interesting of the bunch.
Okay. Well, I've got two honorable mentions as well. For me, Lower Decks. Just for the sheer fact that it raises some really great questions of duty and honor, and I'll really leave it at that. There's some really good ethical questions, I think, that get raised in the episode. But really, for me, it was just the questions of duty and honor among these junior officers, the conversations that they had, and kind of their perception of what's going on around them that I found really fascinating. Anytime Star Trek gives us another perspective as opposed to just those bridge officers, anytime they give us another perspective, I always find it fascinating to get to see the world of the Federation, what's going on in a starship from other perspectives. But again, for me, philosophically, it was the questions of duty and honor that were raised in their conversations. I found this episode fascinating. The other one for me, Zachary, was the episode Masks. The idea of hermeneutics that I think is presented in this episode is very fascinating, because they're trying to solve a puzzle of sorts. And in solving that puzzle, you know, they really have to decipher all of the signs, and they have to come to some conclusions about what these signs and symbols and things meant then and what they mean now. So I thought it was really interesting, kind of this paring down of religion and hermeneutics that I always find fascinating anytime they discuss those in the Star Trek universe. So I actually really enjoy this episode for that reason.
You know, I struggled. I almost put that on my list, but in my mind, it's such a terrible episode, although I really enjoy it, despite the fact that it's such a terrible episode.
Yeah, it's one of my guilty pleasures. I'll call it one of my guilty pleasures.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little painful to watch, but I like it anyway. You know, it does have the hermeneutics element. There's a question of interpretation, but I don't think, though, in my mind, I don't think those are strong enough to justify putting it on my list. You know, they're mentionable, but they're not anything to dwell upon. They're not the dominant features of those episodes. Kind of like time travel and time travel paradoxes in Firstborn. It's there, it's present, it's a theme, but it doesn't make any deep claim about it. And I think the same is going on with Masks. Although I really like the episode, there's some amazing acting from Brent Spiner in that episode, and you know, it's a watchable episode, just not worthy of my top Essential Trek episodes in season 7 of TNG. Well, Mike, do you want to wrap us up with any final thoughts on season 7 of TNG as a whole, now that we've fleshed out our lists?
Well, let me give a quick recap of what we come up with. Zachary, on your list was Force of Nature. You and I both agreed that Parallels was Essential Trek philosophy from season 7 of The Next Generation. Inheritance was also on your list. You and I agreed on Journey's End. Emergence was another episode that you and I both had on our lists. I had All Good Things and Homeward. And then your honorable mentions were The Pegasus and Firstborn. My honorable mentions, of course, were Lower Decks and Masks. So for my final thoughts, I just want to say that, again, there were some real hits, I think, in the seventh season of The Next Generation, but there weren't a lot. And as you and I have done now 40 episodes of Metatreks, we've discussed several of these episodes. I think some of the better episodes we've discussed to some degree or another in previous episodes of Metatreks, and I've tried to, you know, try to mention those in the archives so our listeners are able to go back and listen to those. But I think we've already mined to some degree some of the really rich philosophical content from this season. Although I will say that I was very pleased with the conversation we had today about Emergence. I think that might be one of those episodes that maybe just for the purpose of discussing emergentism, we should probably plan on discussing that one a little bit more depth sometime down the road. But just for my final thoughts, as it has been with every final season of Star Trek, a lot of hit and miss, not a lot of philosophical content. But surprisingly, I mean, we came up with a pretty good list of some essential episodes that are very rich, raise some really interesting questions, dive into some really great content, philosophically speaking. So I think it's there. And I hope as our listeners are going back and they're doing the rewatches and just enjoying this 50th anniversary year of Star Trek, that they'll go back and maybe appreciate something a little different, something new about these episodes that perhaps they didn't appreciate before.
Well, Mike, it turns out we have between us exactly 7 episodes from season 7 of TNG. So it's the top 7 at 7 here. You know, for my final thoughts on season 7 of TNG, I think that in order to really appreciate what's going on in the season, you have to really enjoy thinking abstractly. You know, if you're not the kind of person that enjoys abstractions, you're not going to understand season 7 of TNG. Look at, you know, an infinite number of parallel worlds in Parallels. Look at emergent properties in Emergence. Look at even Masks that you mentioned. Look how abstract of an episode that is in general, right? If you're not the kind of person that is drawn to abstractions, you know, season 7 is not going to necessarily appeal to you. On the other hand, I'm so impressed at the ability of Brannon Braga mainly to write stories along these lines, and for the filmmakers who put together these episodes of TNG to find ways of displaying these concepts visually. I mean, this is an incredible challenge, and this is a really interesting visual treat. And you get to see weird stuff on the Enterprise. You get to see all the weird stuff that happens in Mask. You get to see all the weird stuff that happens in Parallels. All the weird stuff that happens in Emergence. All of which, if you take any of those things literally, they're terrible episodes. So you know, if you look at these episodes purely dramatically, I think they fail in a lot of regards. On the other hand, if all of these are metaphors for ideas and possibilities and philosophical theories, then season 7 is quite a bit more interesting than it looks at first glance. And so I hope that if you're listening to this episode and season 7 of TNG is not your favorite episode, try to rewatch these episodes with these philosophical theories in mind. You'll see that this is a really rich season. It fails dramatically. It's not the best season of TNG by a long shot, right? But if you're looking for philosophical content and you really enjoy abstract ideas and philosophical theories and competing theories, you get competing theories in these episodes. This is a philosophical dialogue brought to screen in ways that we just haven't seen visually before. And I think, you know, the danger for us being Star Trek fans is that we've seen these episodes so many times that we've, in our minds, in our own headcanons, we've separated the good from the bad. Mm-hmm. Good episodes, bad episodes. Episodes I like, episodes I don't like, right? It's easy to forget that way back in 1994, the vast majority of television viewers, and even the vast majority of Star Trek fans, had never been exposed to these kinds of visual presentations of abstract theories like this. This was genuinely groundbreaking new territory for Star Trek and new territory for how to present philosophical ideas in a dramatic format in a science fiction television TV show on TV. And this is something we've become used to. Oh yeah, Star Trek deals with philosophy. Look at this weird stuff that happens in Star Trek. It just, you know, put all of that out of your mind and think back to circa 1994, and everything you see in season 7 of TNG was new and had never been seen on screen before. And it was really fascinating and interesting, so much so that we're still talking about it 22 years after the fact. So I think for my final thoughts, I just want to encourage listeners to watch these episodes with fresh eyes, think about the theories we've talked about, and see what an amazing job the makers of The Next Generation did with this season, even though the episodes may not be your favorites and may fail in some regards dramatically. It's a really rich season, and I'm kind of amazed. You know, we found some really interesting threads to follow up on. I agree, we should totally do an episode on Emergence, mainly because I think Emergence is just the fundamental question in philosophy of science and in our understanding of reality. And no matter what you're interested in, you have to deal with the question of reductionism versus emergence. You don't get off the hook and you don't get to not address that question no matter what you're studying. You could be studying English literature and you can find something to talk about with emergence theory. Maybe that's an interesting challenge for when we do Metatrex on that topic. But season 7 of TNG isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
They're heading into a tough situation. Maybe an alien ship is coming up or something, and the captain says, go to red alert, and then the camera quickly pans over to the other side of the bridge, and that robot is going, danger, danger!
I think they should have a character named Rob Willerson, and he can say, danger, Rob Willerson!
The orb.
Well, it connects you more with reality as opposed to sort of an academic view of a situation.
Right. I mean, there's no high lofty ideals going on here.
That's
it,
what I mean.
It's really just survival.
Survive to the next day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Because he thinks this is one of the 5 best movies ever made, and it ends with Spock dying, and you know that there's a sequel called The Search for Spock, and you're never like, I wonder how they got out of that mess. You're just like, nope, this is it. This is good. This is the perfect ending. I'm done.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail, look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
We're also on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/trekfm. And while you're there, check out the Babel Conference. That's Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. It's a closed group, but if you click join, we'll let you right in. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
And we should add that the Babel Conference is an excellent place to keep the discussion going if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with us there. Pick up on any threads we've talked about and share your thoughts. We really want to hear your thoughts on everything we've talked about today. We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Mike, when you're not blinking your eyes in a Fourier pattern, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, Zachary, I'm always on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, certainly around the Babel Conference on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not on the Orient Express headed for Keystone City, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs?
Well, you can find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter, and my handle there is just my name, @ZacharyFruehling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruehling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp. We'd like to thank our art director, Aaron Harvey, and our production manager, Richard Marquez. We'd also like to take a minute to thank our two associate producers for MetaTreks. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle @MagicDrop5. And we'd like to thank Kay Elizabeth Janeway, and you can find her under the Twitter handle @ChocoWeeble. Again, we really want to thank you for your support of MetaTreks in particular and the entire Trek FM network in general. Thank you very much for your support. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.